Well, hello. I am very honored to meet with Dr. Deborah Raniger, who is the author of a remarkable book. The name of the book is Against the Current, A Conscientious Objector During World War II and the Daughter He Inspired. And can I call you Deborah?
Yes. Okay. Yes, thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Well, this is a remarkable book. And one of the wonderful, remarkable things about it is that it takes only 2 hours to read.
That was intentional, by the way.
I thought it might be after I read your book. So what inspired you to write this book?
It was something of a duty, in a way, I think, an obligation to my family, because this was a story that I grew up with. My father started sharing this story with me when I was probably 8, and I was aware of the work that he had done. And by the time I got into high school, he was trying to write the story himself. And I would watch him struggle to write and rewrite different experiences that he had during the time that he served as a conscientious objector. And then my mother got in the game, and she tried to help him too, because he was handwriting everything, and she bought him a typewriter, and he plunked away at it. But and then she took it away from him and said, "I'll type it up for you." But she didn't get very far with it, and it was when she was in her late 80s and not in good health, she handed it all over to me and said, "Okay, you do something with this."
Yeah.
So I felt a very deep sense of obligation, and not just obligation, but importance. I felt that this was a really important story that needed to be told. And as time went on, particularly in the last 10 years or so, I had some experiences with people suffering from mental health and became more...
Mental illness.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. And really felt compelled mm-hmm. to get out this body of work that I had inherited and figure out how to make something with it. So,
well, before we get into the book a little bit more, I have to ask you, how long did it take you to go through all of those boxes and boxes of pages?
Well, it took me a full year just to transcribe everything.
That's pretty good.
Because my mother had only typewritten up, I think, maybe 2 stories, and the majority of it was still all handwritten. So it took a full year to transcribe that onto a computer where I could start manipulating it and working with it.
So, listener, this book that Dr. Raniger wrote about her father and her relationship with her father, Against the Current, her dad was really larger than life. And we're going to just briefly mention some of the things he did to pique your interest, and hopefully you will go out and get your own copy of the book. But your dad came from a Jewish family.
Yes. Syracuse, New York.
Syracuse, New York. And he grew up, he was very big in the Boy Scouts when he was a kid, became an Eagle Scout, actually went to the Jamboree in 1929. Where he met a Japanese Boy Scout named Kiyoshi
Yaki,
and they became fast friends. And then if you fast forward to the beginning of Hitler's rise and the beginning of World War II, here is this man who had gone to the Jamboree where his eyes had been opened to the world and to friendships around the world. And he is being told that he's going to be conscripted to go fight in the war. And he is a conscientious objector. Even as a Jewish man, he did not want to go and wage war and certainly didn't want to go and possibly encounter having to kill his good friend. So it's the story of a Jewish conscientious objector during World War II and the directions that his life takes after that. We can talk a little, because it's not a murder mystery. It's not like we're going to spoil it. We can talk a little bit about the directions that his life took. It's, as I read it, you used an expression that I really loved. It was ripples of change because of a decision made. I think that was his quote, actually. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he's a conscientious objector, and his family is aghast. They are good traditional Jews, and they cannot understand this. And they reject him.
And it wasn't just his family, the entire community. Because at that time, you know, in the early 40s in Syracuse, the Jewish community lived together in a very tight part of the town. Everybody knew everybody else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it was reported in the paper, and so his family was ashamed. Enraged and ashamed. And so he
was... Up until that time, he kind of was the golden child, wasn't he?
Yes, yes. And they had great hopes that he would become a rabbi, and he'd gone to law school. He graduated from Harvard Law, and they were just,
So I was reading some statistics, which I always have trouble saying, and I believe it was on page, I'm going to find it here. I've lost it, but what it was the statistics of how many people tried to get conscientious objector status, and of those people that tried during World War II, and there were, I think, 75,000 or more, only 6,000 were actually granted conscientious objector status. Now, the consequences for this were still severe. They didn't just let you go about your business as a conscientious objector. You had to report for where they were going to assign you. It basically was secured. Mm-hmm. And he was sent to do logging.
Right.
Where?
In New Hampshire. Gorham, New Hampshire.
Okay. And then the story gets wilder.
Yes, it does.
I cannot imagine this, but your dad and the people that he was assigned with to chop wood decided that they really weren't doing much to help the war effort, and that their efforts would be better placed working with the mentally ill in mental hospitals, basically. So he went AWOL. Mm-hmm. To go talk to his commanding officer? Mm-hmm. Can you imagine that? He didn't go AWOL to run away. He went AWOL to go talk to his commanding officer in Washington, D.C. He made it that far and actually got to see him.
Yep.
And why don't you take that story?
So, before I go there, I should give a little bit of background. So the conscientious objectors were told that they were going to be doing work of national importance.
Right.
And simply taking the work away from loggers and cutting wood did not, to them, feel like work of national importance. It felt like they were taking other people's jobs away.
Good clarification. Thank you.
Meanwhile, many of the people who had been staffing state mental hospitals across the country had been conscripted into the war. They'd been drafted because they were short-staffed. And so the state mental hospitals were having a very difficult time taking care of patients. And word had gotten out that the War Board was developing a program to send conscientious objectors into the state mental hospitals to help with the staffing shortages.
Thank you.
So that's how they came up with the idea, or where that the genesis of that idea was, for them to see what they could do to be transferred to another service location.
Okay, thank you, because I didn't explain that quite as much in the book, but that really makes a difference. Yes. Yeah.
And so he actually did. He went AWOL, and the other guys covered for him, and he hitchhiked from the woods of Gorham, New Hampshire, to the Capitol. And I still can't believe it, but he did. Without an appointment to see Colonel Kosh. He just walked in there and said, "You need to see me. I need to see you."
That's fabulous. And not only did he not get immediately slammed in jail for going AWOL, but then what happened?
Well, the colonel listened to him and said, "Well, I can't make any guarantees, and you might end up in jail, but I'll see what I can do." And he, I don't know exactly how many weeks later, but it wasn't too much long later after that, that he and the other men who he had identified that wanted transfer were in fact transferred to the Philadelphia Byberry State Hospital, mental hospital.
I don't think you'd hear too many stories like that now.
No. I doubt it.
Yeah.
I doubt it.
So he goes there and he finds horrible conditions.
Yes, deplorable. Just almost unspeakable conditions, really.
Right. And he learns a lot and he starts to treat the patients there with some dignity.
Yes.
And perhaps you could describe a little bit of what he does.
Well, first of all, some of the wards, the men didn't even wear clothes. They were the incontinent wards, and their mattresses were not cleaned on a regular basis. And my father's job was to clean the mattresses and clean the latrines, and he started conversations with the patients and befriended some of them and recruited some that were more able to help him. And then from there it went to making small games up where they could win prizes of candy or a comb or just small trinkets and things.
So he's
for helping
treating
out.
Them like human beings.
Yes. And they responded really well to that. And
didn't he start a newspaper too?
Yes, he started a newsletter because he realized that there were COs like the group of them at Byberry State Hospital that were being sent to other state hospitals around the United States. Mm-hmm. And so he and the other guys that he was with started the newsletter, and it was distributed around the country. And it was a way to share ideas and raise awareness about positive ways to improve the situations for the patients in their respective mental hospitals.
And he had the track record by that time to show that these things actually worked.
Yes, yes. And one of the other COs was a photographer and started taking pictures of sort of the before and after.
Right, which would have been shocking.
Yes.
And it's shocking in the book.
Yes, yes. And I didn't include all of the pictures that I had because it can be overwhelming pretty quickly.
Right.
So I just put a few choice pictures
right.
in there.
So then he and his fellow conscientious objectors that are working in the hospital have an idea.
Yes.
And this is just as amazing as going AWOL. Would you explain what they decide to do?
They decided that, the newsletter was circulating just to the COs, but it actually got broader than that because it was also being sent to Colonel Kosh, the War Board, the American Friends Service Committee, personnel that were overseeing the selective service effort on site in different states. So word was getting out, and they came up with the idea that they really needed to raise national awareness. They were raising the awareness of the COs that were working in the hospitals, but now it was time to get the public involved, that everybody needed to see how terrible the situation was. And
your dad was a true activist. You know that, don't you?
Yes. And you know, there needed to be policy changes. There needed to be significant changes to the way the state mental hospitals were run. And of course, we're still saying that today.
Yes.
So yes, changes were made back in the 40s and 50s, but we still have a lot.
We do have a long ways to go, but they decided that they needed to contact Eleanor Roosevelt to get the word out.
Yes.
And how in the world did they get her attention?
It turned out that the head of the American Friends Service Committee, who was connected with, was working and aware of the conscientious objector effort, knew Eleanor Roosevelt. And the connection got made between some of the peace leaders who were Quaker and Mennonite, who were people that my father and the other COs knew and went through an approval process to get the newsletter started. They helped make the connection to Mrs. Roosevelt, and she had already actually gotten a copy of the newsletter, and it had piqued her interest because she was really interested in social change.
Yes, she was.
And she agreed to meet with my father and a few of the other conscientious objectors. And what they were proposing was a foundation to raise money to educate people on best care practices of the time and to educate people on what was mental illness and what could be done about it. And if you had a family member, how could you help them? And some, you know, basic things like that. But on a national level.
Right.
Right. And so Mrs. Roosevelt got involved and agreed to help sponsor the National Mental Health Foundation, which is what they decided to call it. And she enlisted Mrs. Harry Truman, because this was happening right as the war ended, and then Truman became president.
Right.
And so Mrs. Harry Truman and Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt got involved in the National Mental Health Foundation. And then, of course, Mr. Truman became president. And because of his association with his wife and knowledge about the National Mental Health Foundation, within a very few months' time, the National Institute of Mental Health was officially established. And a lot of that had to do really with the national awareness raising that my father and the other COs had been doing with their newsletter. And then they started having all the things you usually do with a nonprofit, you know, fundraising, conferences.
And by this time, by the way, the war is over. He stayed on working in the mental hospital after the war was over because of his interest in improving the lot of everybody that was suffering from mental illness.
Yes.
And so after they started the foundation, at some point, you know, that is such an amazing... Your dad, I wish I'd known him. Just meteoric.
Yes.
And very dedicated. Clearly, he was not just shirking the war. He had other things that he was dedicated to, which is just wonderful. I'm thinking back to like when we started the war on Afghanistan, how all these knee-jerk responses, these flags were flying everywhere, and then anybody who was not in favor of the war against Afghanistan was called unpatriotic and was, I had things thrown on me, and everybody I know who did that had that problem. I'm sure sentiment was very strong at the beginning of World War II, too. And to be Jewish, his courage is just astounding.
Yeah.
He must have been a very confident person.
Yes, he very much was. And confident in the stands that he took, and he didn't waver.
Right.
You know, in spite of really being shunned by his family, and my mother, in her decision to marry my father, experienced a lot of that too, because her family was not happy with him. So,
well, then I want to go back a little bit. We dived right into the conscientious objector stance and going to chop wood, but your father, who had an excellent education, and while he was still, he wasn't in the logging camp yet, he met your mom, and they basically hit it off, and then he was sent out to the logging camp. Your mom had a good bit of courage, too.
Yep.
Yeah. And her help in all of this sounds very quiet, but she helped in piecing the book together. She helped with artwork, because that was her background.
Mm-hmm.
She helped in so many ways. She really was an aid to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she definitely was.
Yeah. So your dad has some kind of falling out with the other people that are working on the foundation with him.
Yes.
And he heads out to California.
First, by way of Denver. He stopped and they lived in Denver for a couple of years, and he taught speech, rhetoric, and public speaking and debate at the University of Denver, I believe it was.
Okay.
They were there, I don't know, two, three years, and then they moved to the Bay Area.
And which Bay? We're talking Monterey or?
San Francisco.
San Francisco Bay. Okay, and there's more adventures.
Yes.
So he did real estate.
Real estate became his predominant career. And then as the decades rolled by, I was born. And by the time I was in the fourth grade, you know, we were into the civil rights era. In the Bay Area, we were now living in Palo Alto Bay Area, and the housing was segregated. There was a black community and the rest of Palo Alto.
Are we talking about the 60s then?
So we're talking about the 60s, and redlining was really a big thing.
Yeah.
And if you were African American, you could not buy a home except in a very narrowly prescribed geographic area. Mm-hmm. And the schools were segregated too. And my father thought that was just all wrong. And he started
pushing against it. Yeah.
Pushing against it and saying, I'm not going to discriminate. And, you know, we need to have fair housing. And he got very involved in the whole fair housing policy changes at the local and state government. And
so once again, he's pushing against the current.
Yes. And he almost lost his real estate brokerage because of it. He was getting threatening calls, and the California Board of Realtors came out publicly against him. And yeah. And then, of course, well, there were, I'm not going to get into the political details and the Rumford Act and everything else, but eventually, you know, the Civil Rights Act passed and things began to change.
So at some point he ran for city council.
Yes, and it was during that period of time, he was very interested in affecting local change as well as national change. And he lost that race because of his stance on fair housing.
And in 1966, after we came out with the Wagner Act,
mm-hmm.
California ended up voting for Proposition 14.
Can you explain the Wagner Act and Proposition 14?
Well, I believe the Wagner Act was the one that declared that discrimination against housing was illegal. Am I wrong about that?
I think it was the Rumford Act.
The Rumford Act, excuse me.
Yeah.
All right. So then
got overturned.
It got overturned with Prop 14.
Right.
In 1966.
So basically, with Prop 14 in California, you were allowed to discriminate.
Yeah.
Wow.
And my father ran for the city council on the platform that everybody should have a right
to live
anywhere.
Yeah.
And so he lost the race on the city council because there was a contingent of people that wanted everything to stay segregated.
So in 1969, your dad, who had bought some property in the Bay Area and encouraged other people to buy in with him.
Right.
And it was a really good deal at the time, but then the property values went down and it was just a big bust. And he ended up merging his company with an international real estate firm.
Right. So, but there's a missing hole there that I want to
fill in
briefly. So after Prop 14 was overturned, the National Civil Rights Acts passed, there was a lot of unrest going on across the country during the 60s, during that time. And there was, I think my father, because he had been selling houses, mm-hmm. primarily felt that, and because he'd lost the city council and he'd lost some business, he lost business. Mm-hmm. And he decided that he had to do more in real estate than just focus on houses. And so he got involved, he broadened his practice to land investment.
Okay.
Because people were discriminating against him because they didn't like his platform on civil rights. So he broadened it to land investing.
Okay.
And then he had developed these investment groups, and they had bought in as a group on a share of land that was in what has become the Silicon Valley. He was prescient in his vision. and then the Santa Clara County declared a moratorium on land development, and the investors panicked and everybody mm-hmm. wanted out.
Thank you for supplying that.
Yeah. And so around that time, he sold his business to a large real estate company because our family was on the brink of bankruptcy because
right.
we couldn't buy everybody's shares
right.
back.
I didn't really get into the story of the Jamboree, the Boy Scout Jamboree,
mm-hmm.
but I want to go back a little bit. That was a huge turning point when your dad was young.
Yes.
When he went to England in
yes.
1929 and met his good friend Kiyoshi Yagi. Excuse me. Now, he's joined this international real estate firm, and I forget his position, but anyhow, he's going to travel a lot to Japan.
Right.
And he decides that he really would like to look up his old friend.
Right. Right. So we're now in, it's like 1972, I think.
1973.
Yes. So when he sold his business to the large real estate corporation, they hired him on as well. And so he got involved in, and because of the moratorium, people in the Bay Area did not want to invest in land in the Silicon
right.
Valley. But
that was short-sighted of them, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes. however, he had been talking with some folks and came up with the idea that, well, yes, but people in Japan might like to invest. People in China might like to invest.
Right.
And he made some connections. My father was very good at picking up the phone and cold calling people that he thought would be interested in hearing about his ideas. And that's what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And made some connections and got permissions. And
sounds like he was a born fundraiser.
Yeah, he was. He was definitely.
We need him on Radio Tacoma now.
So yes, he before he knew it, he was on his way to Hong Kong and to Japan on behalf of the company to talk with investors in Hong Kong and in Japan, in Tokyo and Kyoto, about investing in land. Mm-hmm. And that's when he decided he would try to track down his friend.
And after, I think it was 4 calls.
Yes.
He finally did.
Yes.
And there was his friend Kiyoshi. And they got to be reunited again. And he found out that Kiyoshi never did have to fight in the war,
right,
in World War II, because he was also very involved in Boy Scouts or whatever they called it in Japan.
Scouting Association.
Scouting Association, and ended up being the head of the Japanese Scouting Association, and so was able to not fight.
Yes.
Which is wonderful.
Yes. Yes. The two had stayed true to their friendship, in spite of the fact that for decades they were out of communication with each other.
Right. We're not done yet, but I want to go back a little bit and ask you a few questions about the mechanics of your book.
Sure, sure.
So I think the listener understands the significance of the title of the book, Against the Current, because a lot of your dad's life was against the current.
Yes.
And I loved I really love your writing. It's direct, and it's so clear, and it's so readable. And I appreciate that. But you use colors a lot in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that was your mom's influence, was it?
Yes. Yes. And her artistic background and my artistic background. Yeah.
Okay. So you use the word yellow, the color yellow, a lot. And as your book segues into a different section, you'll present a color and then do the definition of that color that fits in the section that's going to follow.
Right. I use colors as kind of a wayfinding device throughout the book to point the reader toward where we're going.
Right. And it works. It works. What sort of research did you do for this book?
Well, as you might imagine, some of the astounding things that my father did, I wasn't entirely sure if they were really true.
Yeah.
And yeah. I felt like I needed, because my father was a very exuberant individual, or was it many, many times, and he sometimes tended to exaggerate a little bit. And so I felt, for the veracity of the story, I needed to confirm the facts. And I will preface this by saying there were actually already 2 books that had been written about the work of conscientious objectors during World War II. And I had these books in my possession at the get-go, because people had come and interviewed my father and the other COs, and had written 2 very academic, thorough books. And so I had a clue of what had happened and where to start. But I wanted the actual documents. I wanted more than that. And I wanted to write a book that was not academic. I wanted to write a book that was very readable.
Thank you for that.
Was not something that only, you know, people working on PhDs would read. So I, in 2019, before the pandemic, just before the pandemic, in October of 2019, I took a trip to Philadelphia. And there I spent a few days at the national headquarters of the American Friends Service Committee. And then I went to Swarthmore College, where they have a piece collection, and spent a couple of days there going through their archives in both locations and finding the documentation that I was looking for. So I actually found the letter that was written after the visit to Eleanor Roosevelt.
Wow.
Detailing the visit. And I went, yes!
Wow.
Yes!
This is fantastic.
So that was one of the main pieces that I was really looking for. I wanted some concrete proof, and it's in the appendix of the book. But there were other pieces, too, that I was able to get in going through that. And I wanted to see if I could find anything about why my father abruptly left the National Mental Health Foundation mm-hmm. after, you know, within 6 months after it was founded.
Right.
And I found a little bit of information on that, enough to make me really think that he was maybe moving into one of his manic episodes.
Well, and that's a really good segue, because we haven't talked about that at all yet.
No,
really.
No.
And you have a section in the book, I forget which color it's under, but it's your friend's son.
Right. The chapter's is called Brokens.
That's right. That's right. And you take him to the store, and he ends up...
Shoplifting. Yep.
Which starts to get the wheels rolling for you.
Right.
Because that was something that you discovered...
when I was 12, that my dad was doing. Yes.
And here's this brilliant Harvard-educated man...
Shoplifting candy. Yes.
And then you started to put the pieces together, his times when he would just disappear to the cabin.
Yep.
When he was depressed.
Yep.
And be gone for long periods of time.
Yep.
His exuberance at times.
Yep.
His recklessness toward the end.
Yeah.
Doing different things.
Yeah. Yeah. It was that experience that I... had all of these flashbacks that I had long suppressed that came out, and I went, oh my gosh, I think my dad was bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I had to go back over all the research again, and all of these moments, like his hitchhiking AWOL to Washington, D.C., I thought, you know, I think that was a manic episode.
Right.
And everything suddenly became framed differently for me when I realized the pattern was finally became clear.
Right.
And my mom and I struggled for decades wondering what was going on with my dad, because he would have these extreme highs and extreme lows. And back, you know, in the early 60s, you didn't talk about.
But I want to go back now. Do you think your dad had any inkling or enough insight when he was working in the mental hospital to realize that he might have a problem?
I think on some level, yes. I think that's where his humanity toward... I think he connected with some of those patients and realized, you know... I could be here.
I'm nodding, listener.
I suspect that. I don't know. I will never know. Because we never talked about it. He
right.
passed away in 2006. And my big aha moment happened, you know, in, 2017, 2018.
Right.
So it was something that our family never discussed. My cousins had no idea.
Well, there was so much shame, and there's still so much stigma around it.
Yes, there is. Yeah.
And it needs to end, but I don't know when that's going to happen.
Right.
You know, when I was doing mental health counseling with teenagers primarily, and I loved working with kids with thought disorders, and one of my highest compliments... and maybe I should rethink this, but one of my highest compliments is when one of my clients, I always call them clients, not patients, said to me, I think I can work with you. You're just like me. And I knew there was a bonding moment. And
yeah.
So there is that ability.
Yes.
There is that ability.
Yeah. So, yeah, I will never know that, but I know he, particularly in later years, he got involved with the National Addiction Research Addiction Research Foundation.
Right.
And he was doing work. So I think, you know, it's not something he would talk about, but I think on some level
he knew.
He probably knew that he was different.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether he, I mean, the word bipolar wasn't even being used then. But he may have known that he would talk about the fact that he had highs and lows that seemed to be deeper mm-hmm. on both ends than most other people.
Right.
So he expressed it in that way.
Yeah. I found it interesting when you talked about your dad insisting that you take public speaking. We're on a different subject now. And I think you were 9 or 10 years old.
Yeah. At the
and
temple.
And that whole part about fresh fish for sale.
Yes.
Because after I read this book, I realized you were using his exhortation to be short, direct, and to the point. If you have something for sale, don't give it a lot of verbs and adjectives. It's just fresh fish for sale. And I loved the approach of fresh fish for sale in this book. It was brilliant.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm glad you noticed that because it was, I wanted to write it in a style that my dad could say, yes, this is exactly what I meant with fresh fish for sale.
Yeah. So when he got involved, let's see, I'm going to find that place, the Addiction Research Foundation, and they established...
Avram Goldstein.
Pardon?
Avram Goldstein.
Yes.
In Palo Alto.
And they ended up doing some research on endorphins and founding the first methadone program.
Yep. Yep.
Your dad is like, what was the name of that movie? Forrest Gump. He's in every place at the right time. Yeah. So what I didn't mention in our conversation, and I'm really curious about this. So after your dad left the East Coast, mm-hmm. and by the time he got to California... He had switched his name from Leonard
Edelstein
to Len Cornell.
Yes.
And part of that was in reaction to his Jewish family and his neighbors and his community completely pushing him away.
Yep.
And
there's more to it, too, though. I mean... In the Bay Area in the 50s, people who were Jewish were discriminated against. You couldn't join a country club.
I couldn't join a country club in Bethesda, Maryland growing up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the YWCA, the YMCA, if you were Jewish, you were not invited.
That's right.
So there was the YMHA, the Young Men's Hebrew Association. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, we would go visit my grandmother in Pittsburgh without my dad because my grandmother hated my dad.
This is your mother's mother.
Yes. But we would go swimming at the YMHA because those other places were not open to people who were Jewish. So getting established in real estate or anything for that matter, because my cousin's father was a doctor and he had difficulty getting established in the Bay Area was challenging.
Sure.
Jews were discriminated against. So I think changing his name to Cornell, he could be kind of a chameleon.
Mm-hmm. It was the easy way. Which doesn't sound like your dad.
No, I know, I know. It's a bit of a contradiction, isn't it?
It is. Well, I think he
also had resentment toward his father, and he didn't want to carry his father's name. So
and that was never healed, was it?
No, never was.
I loved this book. I loved the way you wrote.
I'm so pleased.
I loved the subject matter. to this very moment, I'm wondering if I had been a man during the draft for World War II.
Yeah.
Would I have had your dad's courage? I don't know if I would have. That is such an amazing thing to do, to have that level of courage. Mm. And I was going back to 1929 and the Jamboree, because at that point they had a ceremony at the very end called the Wheel of Peace. Mm-hmm. And that was really formative to your dad, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
I don't know whether I can call myself a pacifist if I would be lacking the courage to say no.
Yeah.
If I had been drafted.
Yeah.
I don't know what I would have done. I think about the draft resistors during the Vietnam era. Never is it easy. Always is there a huge social and societal pressure.
Right.
To cave in and do what's expected.
Right.
And yet, you know, we call World War II the good war.
Right.
What are your feelings about that? Do you have mixed feelings?
I think it was a necessary war, unfortunately. I don't know how Hitler, I mean, could have been stopped. He was just on a rampage.
Right.
But at the same time, that coexists in my thought process with my father's stance. And I think that, you know, I think there's room for both.
It's complex.
It's complex.
I look at now with the war in Ukraine and this horrible Putin character, but then I look at the U.S.'s role in that. And I wonder if we're really helping or just prolonging misery or what we're doing.
Right.
What are we doing getting involved?
Right.
And I'm not very clear on that, even though I'm a member of Veterans for Peace. I know personally that violence very seldom brings about true peace. It just brings about suppression.
Right.
And then it pops up later somewhere else. In my work with families in conflict, how can I advocate for them solving problems peacefully if I'm willing to send our treasures, you know, our budget for social things and turn that into budget for military equipment and the military industrial complex? I think I'm genuinely confused.
Well, I don't think we're going to solve the world's problems this afternoon.
No, probably not.
But I do think, you know, when I try to reconcile all of this, I think there's room for each person to make choices, mm-hmm. and to live with those choices that they make. And, you know, I really respect and honor our military and the choices to be in the military and our veterans and what they have done to serve our country. I also think that the work of a conscientious objector is valuable work too. And I think that this story shows that these men were just as much men of conscience as
yes.
the people who allowed themselves to be conscripted during World War II, people who choose to join the military today. They're choices that people make, and I think, fortunately, in this country, we have the freedom to make those choices. And so there's no one right way. There's many different ways which can lead to a better world.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, listener, is your interest piqued? Do you need to read this book? Who do you think would most benefit from this book?
You know, it's interesting. I think that there's a rather broad group of people that will be interested in the book. I think people interested in mental health reform, definitely.
Ding!
People interested in World War II stories, because this is an unusual one.
I'm dinging off on my list.
People interested in history and nonfiction.
Ding, ding.
Local folks in the Pacific Northwest and in California will be interested because the story goes, and Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, I mean, this story crosses the United States.
It does.
And so there's lots of things to be of interest for folks in many different areas.
Families.
In Japan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And anybody interested in the issue of mental illness and mental health?
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and the history of mental health reform. I was talking to some of the some of my NAMI colleagues, and this was new material for them. They were not aware of what had happened during World War II.
Oh, really?
And so, you know, if you were born in the 80s or the 70s or the 60s, you might not know anything about it.
Well, and we didn't talk about this, but this journey that you've been on and the life that you've led growing up when you did led you to also get involved in supporting mental health reform.
Right, right. And it's kind of ironic because my father's trajectory and mine are really very parallel. And I didn't really realize how closely parallel they were until I was in the middle of writing this book. But yes, because of the experience with this young man and other members of my family.
And this is the young man that did the shoplifting.
That was a real pivotal moment for me in terms of getting involved with NAMI, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and seeing what I could do to affect social reform on the conditions that we're living with right now for people trying to find resources for mental illness
diagnoses. It's terrible
diagnoses.
Right now.
Yeah.
Since COVID, it's gotten even worse.
Yeah, and having supportive housing for people with chronic long-term mental illness. I mean, the homeless situation. I need not go on. But I got very involved in that, and still am very involved in that.
And something else that you're doing, I think you ran for city council.
Yes, yes.
There was an issue about a swimming pool, a public swimming pool.
Right, right. Our pool was going. I was living in Kent at the time, and the swimming pool, the King County was going to close all the swimming pools that were in now incorporated areas of the county, unless the cities took them over. And our mayor did not want to take over the swimming pool and close the pool. And I said, no, this is wrong. I have to do something about this. So I ran for city council.
Yeah, and you won.
And I won and ended up serving 3 terms, 12 years. And we got that pool opened, and we ultimately ended up replacing it and building a new one in collaboration with the YMCA. So there's now a nice new swimming pool in Kent. So
wonderful.
It took beyond my term to get it finished.
Yes, but sometimes things are long term.
Yes.
So you've got you talk about parallel trajectories to your father, so you've got that stick-to-itiveness, but you take on big projects too.
Yeah.
You've got courage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and perseverance and a little bit of I don't know, craziness. Determination. Craziness of determination. Because that book, there were days I thought, what am I doing? I'm never going to get this thing done.
So you have, you know, some suggested questions here. I don't know whether you feel like you've already answered this, but what lessons did you learn in writing this memoir?
Not to give up.
Well, that's good. That's important. And where can people buy this book?
It's available right now in on four different platforms. Amazon.
Okay.
And it's available in Kindle and paperback. Barnes & Noble as well. From the publisher, Hellgate Press. Go to hellgatepress.com.
And that's in Oregon.
And that's in Ashland, Oregon.
Yep.
And also bookshop.org if you want to help support independence. Bookshop.org.
We got it from King's Books.
Okay. Oh, and King's has got it. Great.
Okay. Well, we ordered it.
And listener, again, the name of this book, this amazing quick read, direct to the point, won't waste your time book, is Against the Current by Dr. Deborah Raniger, Raniger. And it is at Hellgate Press, and she has given you all the places where you can get it. I highly recommend it. I highly recommend this book. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I just thank you for the opportunity to...
Oh, this was such a pleasure.
...have this little conversation and highlight some of the pieces of the book.
Where do you live now? It didn't sound like you still lived in Kent.
No, I live here. I live in Tacoma.
Oh, yay.
And so, yes, if you're a local Tacoman, King's Books would be a good place to get
I may see you in city council one day.
Well, no, I'm not doing city council.
No. I mean, I go a lot. I just speak up.
Oh. No, I'm happily retired and doing creative projects like this book. So.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.